The Mystery by Ray Comfort, a novel of two wars from Living Waters Publications, dedicated to Raymond Douglas Comfort, the author's father and a veteran of World War II.
Chapter 1. Enemies of the State. Jerry could feel his heart pounding like a hammer in his chest. Blood gushed from his left shoulder as he rounded the corner of what was once a bakery in the city of Bialystok, Poland. Many times he had casually walked to the bakery with friends, purchased soft white bread, and eaten it while it was still hot. But bread was the last thing on his mind, as like a wounded animal, he fled for his life from three Nazi pursuers. Minutes earlier, he and his beloved father had run from the back door as the soldiers burst through the front of their home. Two shots rang out, one hitting his father, and the other striking Jerry in the shoulder. His father dropped to his knees and with an impassioned cry yelled, "Run, Jerry! Run!" As he rounded the corner, he remembered that the bakery had a narrow alley between it and a shoe store. At the end of the alley stood about two dozen old wooden boxes piled against a 6-foot fence. To one side of the boxes, there was a 14-inch gap into which he often crawled. That led under the floor of the bakery, an ideal place to smoke cigarettes with another 16-year-old friend, something his father would have frowned upon, if he knew. His eyes were wild with terror, not only because he had been shot and was being chased by Nazis, but for fear of what had just happened to his father. As he crawled under the bakery floor, he heard another two shots ring out. He stopped moving and whispered, "Dear God, what is happening?" The ground was damp and cold, and there was hardly room for him to lift his head. He looked down at his bleeding shoulder. It was just a flesh wound, but it scared him. The bullet had entered at the top back of his left shoulder, missed the bone, and passed through the other side, tearing the flesh as it went. It was burning as though it had been clamped in a red-hot steel vise, causing uncontrollable groans to come from his mouth. His breathing was deep and fast, and his chest heaved and burned as freezing air was drawn into his lungs. He gritted his teeth and shut his eyes to try and quiet himself from crying, both from the pain of his shoulder and the dread that gripped his heart. Even with his right hand held tightly over his wounds, the sleeve of his shirt was crimson with blood right down to his wrist. Suddenly, his eyes widened in fear at the thought that entered his mind. What if his wound had left a trail of blood? Suddenly, he heard footsteps. It was the unmistakable sound of soldiers' leather-soled boots crunching the stones on the ground in the alley. Jerry held his blood-drenched hand over his mouth to stop his loud breathing. He could hear voices, and through the cracks of the wooden foundation he could see the legs of the three soldiers that had so terrorized his family. His mother and sister. What would happen to his mother and sister back at the house? He prayed that the soldiers would leave them alone. As far as he knew, it was only the men that were being rounded up and shot. From the German dialect he had learned, he heard one of the soldiers say, "He's just a boy." Then he said something Jerry couldn't understand. After that, there was silence, then footsteps leading off into the distance. He slowly took his hand off his mouth, took a deep, blood-tasting breath, and gave a guarded sigh of relief. It would be 10 long hours before he dared to move and, in the dark of the night, make his way back to his home. What was an American family doing in Bialystok, Poland in 1939? 6 years earlier, Samuel Adamson sat on his farm porch in Texas, reading the newspaper. It was September of 1933. On the home front, Robert A. Cheesebro had died. He was the chemist who invented Vaseline. The 96-year-old attributed his long life to eating a spoonful of Vaseline each day. Samuel raised an eyebrow and whispered, "Probably choked to death." It was also the year that Prohibition in the United States came to a jubilant end. Overseas, the largest political party in Germany, Adolf Hitler's Nazi Party, announced a new program of voluntary sterilization for people who were, quote, idiots or schizophrenics, or if they suffer from depression, epilepsy, or if they have physical weaknesses like deafness or blindness, end quote. Since the 1929 stock market crash, Things had been depressing in the U.S. As the Depression deepened and unemployment increased to an all-time high, it was common to see long lines of hungry people waiting for food outside rescue missions throughout the country. The Adamsons' farming market had ground to a sudden halt. That was one of the reasons Samuel Adamson decided to leave his farm in the trustworthy hands of a friend and move his small family to Germany. He had just enough money to pay for the long boat trip and set up some sort of business. His mother was a German Jew living in Waldenburg, and he felt very uneasy about the policies of the Nazi Party. After the death of his father, his mother carried on the family clothing store, and over the years she had built up a number of regular customers. Until recently, she was doing reasonably well, even without her husband's help. But Samuel read in the papers that the Nazis had posted billboards all over the country saying, "German people, defend yourselves. Do not buy from Jews." They had publicly burned books that were un-German. And he had also heard that the school curriculum was being revised to teach race science. Wilhelm Frick, the Nazi interior minister, stated, "The schools must constantly emphasize that the infiltration of the German people with alien blood, especially Jewish and Negro, must be prevented." The small Adamson family, consisting of Samuel, his wife Esther, son Jerry, and daughter Lillian, left New York on a cold day in January of 1934. Lillian was 2 years older than Jerry and had been named after the actress Lillian Gish. When her parents were first married, they saw the star in Victor Seastrom's MGM film, The Wind, and she left such an impression on them, they decided to name their first girl after her. Jerry was named Jeremiah, after the prophet, at the insistence of his Jewish grandmother. He hated the name and was pleased that his friends called him Jerry. But as he got older, he grew to prefer the seasoned sound of Jeremiah. But even though he always introduced himself as such, people insisted on reverting to Jerry. After a long trip across the Atlantic on the French liner Normandy, the family arrived on the shores of France, then traveled by train to Waldenburg in Germany. There was a climate of fear in the city. People hurried about and kept to themselves. Nazis were everywhere with their neatly fitting uniforms and their rigid manner, forever checking documentation. Samuel's mother was standing at the back of the railway station's platform, waiting for soldiers to take a look at the family's credentials. They seemed to take forever, but when they stamped his passport and told him to move on, she walked slowly towards the small family, tears in her eyes, and her lips pulled tight with emotion. It had been a long 9 years since she had seen them, and with the passing of her husband, she pined even more to embrace them once again. Back at her meager apartment, she poured her heart out to her cherished son and his wife. Since the Nazis posted signs saying to boycott Jewish businesses, even her most loyal customers had been afraid to support her. Their fears were justified. There were threats of murder, beatings occurred openly in the streets, and twice her shop window had had bricks thrown through it. She was afraid to write in letters what was happening for fear of Nazi censors, who often took mail from the post office and opened it to see who was and who wasn't supporting the party. As the family sat at the wooden table, she reached across and, like a typical Jewish mother, took Samuel by both of his hands and said how scared she was and how pleased she was to see them. He assured her that things would come right, and the sound of a male voice in the home made her feel so much better. Over the next 3 months, Samuel invested the rest of his savings into the small and ailing business. He retired his mother from the store and changed its name, then advertised that he had purchased it and that it was now American-owned. Fortunately, his mother had married a Gentile, and his birth certificate didn't mention anything about him being Jewish. Much to his mother's relief, that brought back a flood of old customers and set the business back on its feet. Despite the harassment of the Nazis, Samuel enjoyed the challenge of running a business, although he did have a problem with the language. He was in his early 40s and found it hard to retain a foreign dialect. Jerry, however, picked up the language easier from talking with new friends who were fascinated by the fact that an American had come to their school. It was there that he made one particularly close friend. His name was Carl von Ludendorff. Carl was different from the other boys his age. His friendship was more than a superficial fascination for the fact that Jerry came from the country that made movies and where people drove big cars. One day he asked Jerry if he would like to go to church. Jerry attended Sunday school when he was younger, and when he asked his mother if he could go, both she, Jerry, and Lillian decided to attend church together. As the three entered the von Ludendorff's home early on Sunday morning, they were warmly welcomed and then ushered into a living room in which there were about a dozen chairs facing a wooden table. As Jerry sat in the home, he felt strangely peaceful. On the table rested a large opened Bible, a small loaf of bread, and a silver cup. His eyes looked to one side of the chairs at the only picture on the wall, fresh from the bakery this morning. Jerry turned to see a smiling Carl standing by the bread. "Have you ever taken communion before?" he asked as he walked towards Jerry. Jerry explained that he often did when he attended Sunday school at the Baptist Church in Texas. As the boys sat down, Carl explained that they had close links with the Baptists and that their church was called the International Bible Researchers. He smiled and said, "Sounds impressive, doesn't it?" As they were talking, Mr. von Ludendorff entered the room, winked at his son, leaned forward with an extended hand, and said,
"Jerry Adamson, I presume."
In English, but laced with a strong German accent. Jerry shook his hand and said in German, "Nice to meet you, sir." He smiled warmly, then looked at his wife, who was talking to Esther and Lillian, and nodded that it was time to begin the meeting. As the tall man stood behind the wooden table, the dozen or so people took their seats. He grinned broadly and said in his native tongue,
"We are so excited to have such distinguished visitors with us this morning."
His voice then cracked with emotion. He composed himself and, through tear-filled eyes, continued,
"We are truly thrilled to have members of the Adamson family with us today. After I have opened in prayer, for the sake of our honored guests, the rest of the service will be first in German and then in English."
He then looked directly at the guests and said,
"This is not only to help them understand what is going on, but to show off the English skills I picked up while studying for my degree in Great Britain some time ago."
Another smile, then he opened in prayer. Jerry didn't tell Carl that he hated Sunday school in Texas and that he only went because his mother made him. As a child, he never understood why he had to sit for so long and listen to a boring minister. He used to stare at the second hand of his watch as it moved around the face. Then he would count the flowers on the wallpaper. They were in colorful groups, which made it easier. Sunday school gave him a taste of eternity. But today's church service was different. Even if there had been flowers on the wallpaper, Jerry would have ignored them. The conviction in the voice of Mr. von Ludendorff held him spellbound. As the man prayed through squinted eyes, Jerry saw a tear slowly roll down his cheek. He spoke reverently, and even though it was in German, he could understand what he prayed.
"We are so thankful for your great mercy. Thank you for the mystery of Christ. Thank you for your divine provision, for your love. Help me today to speak your mind, that your people might be edified. Now, Father, we pray for this nation. We pray for our people."
His voice cracked with emotion. He stopped for a moment, then continued,
"We pray for our people. May your hand be upon them. We pray for the Nazis. Please, touch this nation. Help us in this time of trial. May your wonderful name be glorified in our lives, whether by life or by death. Amen."
The small congregation echoed the amen. Then there was a rustle of paper as ones opened their Bibles in anticipation of the sermon. Mr. von Ludendorff began.
Today is a very special day for me. It is April 24, 1938, 20 years since I met my beloved bride. 20 wonderful years.
The small crowd watched with delight as he stepped forward, kissed his wife on the cheek, and said with a twinkle in his eye,
And today I love her with even more passion than when we first met.
He then stepped back behind the homemade pulpit and continued.
We are going to look first at Romans 16:25, at the mystery kept secret since the world began.
Jerry sat on the edge of his seat. He loved mysteries and listened with anticipation to what Mr. von Ludendorff would say next.
This is a secret that God himself has hidden from humanity from the beginning of the world. Not only does Paul speak of this mystery in the book of Romans, but he says in Ephesians chapter 3, verse 9, the mystery which from the beginning of the world has been hid in God.
His face seemed to glow as he said,
Do you know what this extraordinary secret is? Have you discovered the mystery?
Jerry's curiosity was stirred. His old Sunday school teacher was a walking cure for insomnia, but this man was rousing something deep in his heart. It was as though he had something to tell Jerry, something he was supposed to know.
The Apostle Paul also spoke of this hidden mystery in the book of Colossians. In his letter to them, he wrote in chapter 1, verse 26, The mystery which has been hid from ages and from generations.
Mr. von Ludendorff looked up again, lifted his eyes above the congregation as though he was seeing something above their heads, and said,
The scriptures say, Awake thou that sleepest, arise from the dead, and Christ shall give thee light. Thank God that he gave light to me as a young man of 17 and revealed this unspeakable mystery. What is this most remarkable mystery? This amazing secret that God has hidden from all the eyes and ears of humanity?
Jerry was at a fever pitch. He felt like calling out, Tell me! Please tell me!
God hasn't left us in the dark as to what this mystery is. Please, turn with me to...
He paused in mid-sentence and looked at his wife with a look of fear. Everyone knew what had stopped him from finishing his sentence. It was the sound of fast-moving cars, the obvious sound of boots, soldiers' boots. Mr. von Ludendorff closed his eyes and whispered,
Dear God, please, not my children.
Suddenly, the door burst open. Nazi soldiers filled the tiny room, seizing people and thrusting them outside. Jerry felt sick with fear as a member of the Gestapo looked over his documents. After glaring at Jerry, his mother, and sister, the officer stamped, April 24, 1938. SS on their papers and spat out that they were to leave and never enter that home again. The experience so scared Jerry, it was a date he vowed he would never forget. April 24, 1938. They didn't have to be told twice to leave. They heard that in other parts of Germany, the Nazis had inter-church meetings and sent the people home, but they thought they were safe in Waldenburg. At school, Jerry made another friend named Stefan who wasn't as close to him as Carl. He'd had a different influence on Jerry's life. He was the one with whom he smoked cigarettes in the cramped hideout under the floor of the bakery. 2 days after the incident at church, Stefan banged on the Addison's door. When it was opened,
wide-eyed, and between breaths he sputtered out, "They have taken away the von Ludendorffs."
"Who has?" Samuel demanded. The boy looked scared and said,
"The Nazis."
Samuel knew that as pacifists, the von Ludendorffs had refused to teach their children Nazi ideology, and he heard that after the church service had been broken up, there was some sort of court hearing set in motion. The details were in the newspaper that night under the heading, "Enemies of the State." This is what he read. Waldenburg, November 29. The courts have had parents removed from their children. They deemed two members of a Christian sect called the International Bible Researchers, Mr. and Mrs. Otto von Ludendorff, unfit to be parents of their two children. The court accused them of creating an environment where the children would grow up as enemies of the state. The children were delivered into the state's care. The judge delivered a lengthy statement reading in part, "The law as a racial and national instrument entrusts German parents with the education of their children only under certain conditions, namely that they educate them in the fashion that the nation and the state expect." Samuel looked up at Esther. She could see the concern in his eyes. He put the newspaper down and gazed towards the door, then back at her and said, "We've got to leave this place." Chapter 2. The Reign of the Reich. Within a week, Samuel sold the business to a German banker, purchased a car, and the family and his mom were on their way to Poland. The year was 1937, and they were pleased to be leaving Germany. Hitler had massed the largest ever gathering of Nazis at a rally in Nuremberg. The streets of Nuremberg were lined with stormtroopers, and every church bell rang as Hitler arrived for the opening of the National Socialist Congress. The Führer reviewed a parade of an incredible 600,000 men. Samuel thought, why on earth would that madman gather so many troops if he wasn't planning to take Europe and perhaps the world? He would wait in Poland, in the city of Krakow, in the house of a Joseph Greenberg, a Jewish cousin, until the U.S. Immigration and Naturalization Service sorted out a few complexities in his mother's application to immigrate. Little did he know that it would be a two-year battle with the U.S. bureaucracy. It seemed that America didn't want Germans migrating to the U.S. They could see how volatile things were in Europe, and after a rally of 22,000 German-American Nazis took place at Madison Square Garden, New York, they virtually closed the doors. Joseph Greenberg was a cheerful man. Samuel remembered him when he lived in Texas as a child. He was always entertaining, either with bizarre hats with feathers sticking out of them, or telling jokes, an endless stream of jokes. He would burst into a room and say, "I have 6 eyes, 3 ears, and 2 noses. What am I?" When people couldn't guess, he would say, "Really ugly," and run out of the room. As an adult, he still loved to make people laugh. Despite Joseph's cheery disposition, Samuel became very frustrated in Poland as he carefully followed what was happening back in Germany. Early in 1938, Hitler promoted himself to military chief, giving him unprecedented power. He named himself the Supreme Commander of the German Armed Forces and seized direct control of foreign policy. In March of 1938, he returned to Austria, his native homeland, and proclaimed Anschluss, a union between itself and Germany. Any opponents were immediately arrested. Hitler held a referendum and concluded that 99% of the Austrian people approved of the Confederation. In October of the same year, his troops marched into Sudetenland, a border area of Czechoslovakia. Large crowds lined the streets and waved Nazi banners and threw flowers into the street as they greeted the Führer. In March of 1939, the cancer spread further, into Prague, the capital of Czechoslovakia. Then he divided the country up into several regions, each under the reign of the Third Reich. Hitler's entry into the city was not as celebrated as in Austria or Sudetenland. Many jeered at the soldiers and others wept openly as the swastika was raised above the buildings. A curfew was immediately put into effect. Public buildings and banks were taken over by the Germans, and the Gestapo fanned through the city with lists in their hands. Samuel could see what was slowly happening. Hitler was taking Europe with little resistance, and because no blood was seen to be spilled, the world leaders were tolerating his fanaticism. Samuel, however, wasn't the only one that could see the time bomb. He was heartened to read that 500,000 people lined the streets in New York to watch 20,000 people in a Stop Hitler march. Through BBC radio, he heard that in England, the British Prime Minister informed Poland,
"Should the Polish government feel that its independence be threatened to such an extent that it had to resist by force, Poland would find Britain and France on her side."
That stirred the demons in Hitler. He told the 100,000 of his followers at a rally that Germany would not allow Britain to initiate their devilish plan. It was only the knowledge that Hitler would be kept in line by the threats of Britain and France that kept Samuel in Poland. Had he known how insane Hitler was and what was about to happen, he would have immediately left the country. In May of the same year, Hitler signed an alliance with Italy, a union which was referred to as a Pact of Steel. Then the madman shocked leaders of Western Europe by signing a non-aggression treaty with the Russians. He then boasted that the treaty thwarted Britain's efforts to form a circle around Germany. Much to Samuel's concern, that left Poland isolated in Eastern Europe. Britain evacuated thousands of children out of London, and France whisked their children out of Paris and awaited the inevitable. Chapter 3. Echoes of Thunder. After 21 years of peace, Europe was suddenly thrust into war again. A massive German force of 1.25 million men swept across the Polish border on September 1, 1939. Russian troops invaded from the east, and Poland began to fall into the hands of a merciless enemy. Britain and France immediately declared war on Germany, fulfilling their defensive obligations to Poland. The two nations released a communique as to why they had invaded, quote, "to bring order to Poland and to help the Polish people confronted with the collapse of their state," end quote. 3 weeks of nightmarish bombing left Warsaw in devastation. The Nazis called the invasion its Blitzkrieg, a lightning war. By the end of September, 60,000 Poles had been killed by the Nazi invasion, 200,000 more were wounded, and 700,000 soldiers were being held in captivity. Krakow was one of the first cities to be invaded. Samuel mistakenly thought that the Polish troops would hold back the enemy front, and that Britain would come to their aid, but the truth was that he and his family were now trapped. If they went south, they would confront hostile Hungarian troops who were sympathetic to the Nazi cause. Since the invasion, he had no idea where the U.S. stood in the war. If they had entered the conflict, then his U.S. documentation would be a death warrant. If they went east, they would face Russian troops who were as merciless as the Nazis. The Germans had taken Bromberg to the north. The only option was to stay where they were and pray. And pray they did. That night, Samuel wept openly and took his family in his arms and prayed for their safekeeping. Jerry had never seen him like this before. Until now, he had scoffed at any thought of faith in God. There was a constant and terrifying sound of war. Echoes of thunder came closer and closer to their home. On the third day, very early in the morning, Samuel's mother awoke to the sound of shots being fired. She climbed out of her bed and looked out the window. In the semi-darkness, she could see soldiers arresting people in the adjacent street and lining them up for questioning. Her eyes squinted as she tried to see if she could recognize any of them. As she did so, she whispered to herself, "It's just the men." She jumped as she felt a hand on her shoulder and glanced around to see Samuel. "They're going to question the men." He shook his head and said, "No." His mother looked inquiringly into his eyes. As she did so, she flinched at the sound of guns being fired in unison and looked back to see about a dozen men fall to the ground. She put her hands to her face and cried,
"My God, they've shot them!"
The noise had been enough to wake up Jerry, who was now standing by the door of his bedroom. He had heard voices earlier and got up and slipped some clothes on, but when he heard the shots, he came out of his room. Samuel ran across, grabbed him by the arm, and said, "They're shooting the men. We've got to hide before..." There was a loud pounding on the door that made their hearts stop. His mother said,
"The back door, quickly!"
Samuel opened the door, pushed his son ahead of him, and said, "Run, Jerry! Run for your dear life!" 10 long, freezing, and painful hours passed beneath the floor of that bakery. The bleeding from Jerry's 2 wounds had stopped, but not until after he had lost enough blood to make him feel dizzy and weak. But it was now dark, and the sound of war had quietened a little. The firing squads had stopped. During the day, they could be heard about every 10 minutes. It took some time to maneuver his sick body back through the tiny hole into which he had crawled. As he stood to his feet for the first time in 10 hours, his head spun and he stumbled into the wooden boxes beside him, making them crash noisily to the ground, sending a wave of fear through his mind. 3 minutes later, he stood in the darkness beside the back window of his house. The curtains were drawn, but he could hear male German voices coming from the living room. There was a tiny gap in the curtain, but he was fearful to lean across to look in case he was seen. Were his mother and sister okay? Did his father and Joseph escape? And whose voices could he hear? His concern for his family partially overcame his fears, and he slowly leaned across and peered into the home. To his relief, 2 soldiers stood with their backs to the window. From what he could see, they were officers of the Third Reich. His mother and sister were huddled together in a corner. Thank God they were alive. The officers laughed as they drank their beer. Then one reached into his pocket and pulled out a coin and tossed it into the air. Jerry's heart sank with pity as he saw the fear in the eyes of both his mother and sister. One of the officers then walked across to his sister and lifted her from the floor. A word flashed across the boy's mind. Rape! Dear God, no! Please! It was then that Jerry felt a wave of an emotion he had never felt before. It was an anger that these animals would rape his mother and sister, and it overcame his dread and seemed to clear his mind. It was then that he remembered a gun his father had smuggled from the States. It was a fully loaded handgun hidden under a loose floorboard in the bathroom. He quickly made his way to the bathroom window and pried it open. For the first time in 10 hours, he wasn't aware of pain in his arm. He quietly slid down onto the floor, dropped to his knees in the darkness, lifted the loose floorboard, and felt for the gun. For a second, he thought it was gone, but then his hand touched something very cold. His heart raced as he grasped hold of the weapon. Only once had his father let him touch it, and that was to show him how to move the safety clip. He carefully moved the clip and held the gun tightly. He quietly opened the bathroom door, entered the dark hallway, and calmed his thoughts. As he stood in the hallway, he could hear the pathetic crying sound of his sister coming from one of the bedrooms, a noise that made him grit his teeth in outrage. He gently turned the handle and pushed open the door to see the dark figure of a man pressing his terrified sister against the wall. He had hold of her wrists and was forcing himself upon her. The officer looked at the change of expression on Lillian's face and then turned his head and mumbled something in German, thinking it was the other officer. But when he saw Jerry's figure standing with a gun, terror filled his eyes in the face of an untimely death. He instantly let go of Lillian and scrambled for his revolver. Jerry fired 2 shots into his chest, then ran to his sister and pulled her up from the floor where she had been dropped. As he did so, he heard the hallway door open and a voice say in German, "Uncooperative, huh?" as he entered the bedroom. Jerry took careful aim at the silhouette and fired another 2 shots. One went through the man's upper chest, and as he crumpled to the ground, he put another bullet into his back. It was then that Jerry collapsed in exhaustion. It was morning before he regained consciousness. The distant sounds of war had become louder as it neared the small home. However, there were no more firing squads in the area, probably because there were no more men in the vicinity who were left alive. As Jerry opened his eyes, the first words that came from his lips were, "Dad, is Dad okay?" His mother seemed to look right through him as she said,
"Your father's dead."
The first shot that came as they ran from the home the previous morning put Samuel onto the ground as it penetrated his leg. The next two shots Jerry heard a moment later went through his father's head as the Nazi soldiers mercilessly ignored his pleas that he was an American citizen. Esther, Lillian, and his grandmother stood in the doorway in horror and witnessed the incident. To the soldiers, Samuel was just another raving Jew, and Jews were to be exterminated. Some went quietly, some protested. The women had also seen Jerry run around the corner and resigned themselves to the fact that he was also dead. They were more than astonished to see him show up at night with a gun in his hand and then kill two Nazis. They then explained the events that had taken place that day. Joseph was immediately dragged from his bedroom and shot with six other men right in front of the house. Their bodies were later picked up by a flatbed truck and taken away. Around mid-morning, two members of the Gestapo pounded on the door and demanded to see each of the women's documents. When they saw that Samuel's mother was a Jew, they arrested her on the spot and said that she was to be taken to Auschwitz under the charge of Hitler's butcher, Adolf Eichmann. When Jerry had gained his composure, he asked where the bodies of the soldiers were. In the blackness of the night, the two women had loaded them into their car and dumped them about a mile from the home. Jerry heaved a deep sigh of relief, then reached around to clutch his aching shoulder muscle. He looked down at a clean bandage and said, "You two have done a good job." Chapter 4. Blood, Toil, and Tears. It was 3 weeks since Samuel was killed, and in that short time, Jerry had matured from a boy into a man. He had to. He needed to be strong to lead his mother and sister, and he needed to be brave. During the 3 weeks, they took turns at driving Joseph's car south into Hungary, then west through occupied Austria, then through into France. Fortunately for them, America was still neutral, and their documents got them through 6 tightly secured border patrols. While their hearts skipped with delight at being let through, they saw so many pathetic sights of Jews, men, women, and children, being rounded up like cattle, both in Hungary and in Austria. In France, Jerry kept a close eye on what news he could find. He heard that 6 people had been killed in Munich on November 8, 1939, when a bomb exploded in a packed hall of Nazi veterans. The bomb had been intended for Hitler, but he had left the hall 15 minutes earlier than was expected. In Prague on November 24, the Gestapo executed 120 students they accused of anti-Nazi plotting. Jerry felt frustrated and disappointed that the U.S. hadn't joined the war. Back in the States, a group of isolationists formed what they called the America First Committee. This group had among its members high-profile figures such as the famed Charles Lindbergh and Robert McCormick, the publisher of the Chicago Tribune, as well as a few senators. Their powerful voices opposed U.S. intervention in the European war, yet Jerry knew that if the Western nations banded together, only then could they defeat fascism. It was this knowledge and the first speech by Britain's new prime minister that made Jerry want to stay in France and do all he could to stop the onslaught of Nazism. As he tuned into the BBC, he heard the distinctive sound of Winston Churchill say,
"I have nothing to offer but blood, toil, tears, and sweat."
His voice moved something deep in Jerry's heart. When he decided to wait in Paris and join the French resistance, he thought that his mother would protest his decision. But she understood. After some discussion, both Jerry and Lillian decided that it would be wise for their mother to return to Texas and take over the farm, and that both of them would stay in Paris for a while, then join her after the war. The French were not as welcoming as Jerry and Lillian had hoped. Many were bitter that the United States had stayed out of the conflict. Despite the many attempts they made to contact the resistance, they were all futile. As far as the French were concerned, any American who had just come from living in Germany couldn't be trusted. He couldn't blame them for having such an attitude. Paris crawled with both Germans and Frenchmen who would betray the resistance for a price. It was only after getting a job serving tables in a small outdoor cafe that Lillian finally made contact with the underground through a man named Mark. As she cleared a table one day, without looking up from a newspaper he was reading, he directed her attention to a man in his early 30s who was sitting at a table drinking coffee. Mark had heard through reliable sources that this man had connections with the resistance. Lillian scribbled,
"Long live France. I must speak with you."
In French on a piece of paper, put it on the saucer of a cup of coffee, and took it to the man's table. 10 minutes later, she returned to clear the table, lifted the cup, and saw what she had prayed she would see. Another small piece of paper. In the kitchen, she carefully unfolded it and read the words,
124 Bordeaux, 7 p.m., alone.
Lillian's heart raced as she knocked on the door of 124 Bordeaux. When it opened, a woman smiled and asked in French,
"Did you come alone?"
Inside, two men and another woman were playing cards and took no notice as Lillian stepped inside and shut the door. The woman said,
"My name is Marianne. What would you like me to do for you?"
"I want to join the resistance. Can you help me?"
Marianne gave a small laugh and said,
"Now why would an American girl who cannot yet bear the 13 years want to join the French resistance?"
"Because the Nazis killed my father and put my grandmother in Auschwitz."
One of the men playing the card game tossed a card onto the center of the table and without looking around said,
"How do we know you are speaking the truth?"
Lillian said,
"You don't."
He smiled, turned and looking at her said,
"Why then should we trust you?"
The woman who let her in whispered loud enough for all to hear,
"I trust her."
The man then said,
"We will contact you at your work."
Then he nodded to the woman to see Lillian to the door. The meeting only lasted about 2 minutes, but it sent Lillian's heart racing, this time with excitement. That night, Lillian thanked God for the meeting, then opened a Bible she had brought with her from Poland. It was a Bible her father started reading while they waited and prayed that the British and the French would reach them before the Germans. That night, she began reading it, something she would do every night from then on. The next day, she lifted 1,000 coffee cups looking for a note, and each time she became more and more disappointed. A week passed, and still no one contacted her. It was evident that they didn't trust her. And just when she had resigned herself to the fact that there would be no communication, she saw a small folded note as she lifted a cup. On it, she read the words,
"If you would like to join our card game, come to 73 Le Havre at 7:30 tonight. We only need one player, so come alone."
Lillian put the note into her pocket, then whispered,
"Thank you, Lord."
Chapter 5. The City of Light. It was now May 1940. Hitler was attacking Holland and Belgium with his blitzkrieg. Jerry huddled close to an old wireless and listened to the BBC report that hundreds of Nazi planes had swooped over their cities, dropping German parachutists, often dressed in Dutch military uniforms. Holland's queen issued a statement saying,
"After our country, with scrupulous conscientiousness, had observed strict neutrality, Germany made a sudden attack on our territory without any warning."
The Belgian Prime Minister declared a state of alarm and hoped that Britain and France would come to their aid. The Germans said their reason for attacking both countries was because they believed that Britain and France were about to use them as stepping stones to invade Germany. The German Foreign Minister stated,
"The Allies were preparing an onslaught on Germany
which the Reich could not tolerate. In the life and death struggle thrust upon the German people, the government does not intend to await an attack by Britain and France.
It took only 2 weeks for Germany to conquer Holland and Belgium, taking them right to the English Channel, making the Allies very nervous, knowing what was next on Hitler's agenda. France's premier, Paul Renaud, was grieved at the loss of the two countries, saying that their surrender made the situation dark and grave. The next day, Jerry heard that President Roosevelt, in an effort to prepare for the worst, direct involvement in the war, announced plans to train 50,000 war pilots. Congress supported him and passed the Army Air Corps in support of his proposal. The month of June was an unspeakably depressing one for France and the two Americans. On the third of the month, 200 German planes dropped a total of 1,100 bombs on Paris, killing many. Then, to their horror, they listened to reports that as German troops fought their way across northern France, they trapped 340,000 Allied troops on the beaches of Dunkirk. The ruthless and confident Germans forced back the battle-weary British, French, and Belgian divisions to a point where it looked like they would be annihilated. When the French and British troops had rushed to the defense of Belgium and Holland, and the country surrendered, it exposed their left flank. Hitler's forces took advantage of this and stormed through the gaping hole, trapping the Allies. Although around 130,000 died, the Royal Air Force fought an air battle with the Luftwaffe and gave time for an evacuation which was hailed as the Miracle of Dunkirk. In 9 days, a massive Allied effort pulled the 340,000 grateful troops back across the Channel. It was a bittersweet victory. That night, Jerry tuned into the BBC and once again was stirred by the words of Winston Churchill, who, despite the evacuation, vowed,
"We shall fight on the seas and oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight on the landing grounds, we shall fight in the fields and in the streets, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender."
All too familiar tears rolled down Jerry's cheeks, partly because of such soul-stirring words, but also because he felt fearful for France. His fears were justified. That which was considered unthinkable a few years earlier happened. Darkness fell over the City of Light. Hitler invaded Paris. It took a mere 10 days for the Germans to take Paris after they began the Battle of France. Jerry wept openly as he stood under the trees and watched the German armored cars sweep down the Champs-Élysées. His heart almost broke to see a sign plastered on the Eiffel Tower, "Deutschland sieg auf allen Fronten." He didn't need anyone to help with the translation. Germany conquers on all fronts. Chapter 6. Family Camps. "Why aren't the Americans helping us?" The question was directed at Jerry and was asked with an unfeigned sincerity by Jean Moulin, the French underground leader. Jerry looked directly at him and said, "With the fall of France, we had hoped that Roosevelt would drop his policy of isolationism. I don't know what will have to happen to bring the United States into the war, but whatever it takes, I hope it will come quickly." Jean's question came in the light of the fact that Italy's premier, Mussolini, united his country with Germany against Britain and France. The BBC aired parts of a speech by President Roosevelt in which he said,
"The hand that held the dagger has struck it into the back of its neighbor."
Jean gave a brave smile, put a fatherly arm around Lillian, and said,
"Still, it's so good to have you two with us."
He was a kind and courageous man. Earlier that month, the Germans arrested him for refusing to sign a statement blaming Sinhalese soldiers for murders committed by the Germans. A German soldier had scribbled a note to him while he was in prison saying, "I compliment you on the energy with which you defend your country's honor." He had also been instrumental in uniting the resistance fighters in the north and the south. Lillian looked up at him and said,
I had given up hope of you ever contacting me. I didn't think you trusted me.
Jean smiled and said, We didn't. We tell you for a week, and we also checked up on where you came from. The fact is, we seldom allow anyone to join the underground if they do not come with a concrete personal recommendation.
He looked at Jerry and said, Your sister's word was good enough for us to trust you.
We are very pleased to have a small part of America with us.
That night, about a dozen members of the resistance sat and listened to General Charles de Gaulle speak from London on the BBC and say,
Whatever happens, the flame of the French resistance must not go out, and it will not go out.
2 years had passed. It was July 16, 1942. Britain had been bombed by Nazi air attacks, and at one time, 60,000 buildings were destroyed by the assaults. In Warsaw, the Germans herded the Jewish population behind an 8-foot wall enclosing the city's ghetto district. The Nazis said they did so to give the Jews a new life in what they called family camps. All Jews were ordered to wear a 6-point Star of David outlined with the word Jew, which was to be worn visibly and firmly sewed to the left breast of the clothing. Meanwhile, Hitler invaded and conquered Yugoslavia after a massive bombing attack. Then he attacked his own ally, Russia, and encircled Leningrad, planning to starve the city to death. The United States finally joined the war after the Japanese devastated Pearl Harbor in Hawaii with a 360-plane surprise attack. News filtered back that Jews were being slaughtered en masse in the dreaded concentration camps, something known as the Final Solution. Hitler said it was the only fate deserved by the Untermenschen, the subhumans. There was a sudden signal knock on the door at the resistance hideout. It was Francois. He was holding a newspaper in his hands as he stepped into the room. He lifted his arms up in despair in typical French fashion, and with a look of disgust threw the newspaper onto the wooden table and said,
I don't believe it. I don't believe it. The man is insane.
By now, both Lillian and Jerry could understand French, even when it was uttered with such passion. Jean picked the newspaper up and whispered something unrepeatable. The article he saw read,
At 3 o'clock this morning, thousands of French police officers fanned out through Paris on an unprecedented mission. They rounded up Jews, 13,000 of them, shoved them into buses, and locked them up in the sports facility known as the Winter Velodrome. Among the people cowering beneath the bleachers are invalids, pregnant women, and more than 3,000 children. The roundup was part of an agreement Vichy-Pierre Laval made with the Nazis. The Germans agreed not to deport any French Jews to Germany if the French arrested fallen Jews. Laval claims he can save 75,000 lives. Critics say that he has bartered with the devil.
Sometime later, a news report filtered back from Warsaw about the new life the Jews were getting in the ghettos in Poland. Over 60,000 were resisting the Nazis. A year earlier, there were 500,000, but many were killed or dragged to the concentration camps. SS troops, under the command of General Jürgen Stroop, attacked the walled ghetto on April 19, 1943, with orders to arrest the remainder. When they entered the area, they began searching it systematically, block by block, house to house, basement to ceiling. When there was resistance, the SS opened fire with tanks, mortars, and machine guns, or they torched the homes with flamethrowers. Word filtered back to the ghettos about what had happened to Jews who were taken to the concentration camps, yet they had nowhere to hide. Jewish resistance fighters who were able to keep one step ahead of the Nazis returned to Warsaw with stories from the ghetto at Lubin. From their apartment windows, Jews could see the fearful sight of the barbed wire at the Majdanek concentration camp, and they could also see the smoke rising from the large crematoriums. Reports leaked back around the middle of May 1943 that there were no more Jews left in the Warsaw Ghetto. Jürgen Stroop, the SS general, said that his troops killed a total of 56,065 Jews, but not all of that number died from Nazi bullets. Many committed suicide by staying in their burning homes or by jumping from their roofs. Around that time, André, one of the trusted members of the resistance, disappeared. After making extensive inquiries, Jean concluded that he had been captured by the Nazis and shot. Little did he know that something worse had happened. As André was leaving his home, he was stopped by two members of the SS, arrested, and taken by car to the outskirts of Paris. There, he was ushered into a small room at the back of a large block church building. The room contained two more high-ranking Nazi officers and the stale smell of a cigar. He was told to sit down in a chair in front of a large desk. Then, through an interpreter, he was told that they had proof he was a member of the French underground, and they would let him go if he would merely give them the address of Jean Moulin. André forced a smile and said he would never betray the resistance. It was then that the officer stood up, walked around, and sat casually on his desk. He was holding two large photographs. He stared at them and said in broken French, "Oh, I think you will." He looked directly at the Frenchman, then handed him the prints. André's heart sank as he stared at the pictures. They were of his beloved wife and his two young daughters. Jean had bent the rules and allowed André to join the resistance only on the condition that he sent his wife and children out of the country. He was fearful that if any of its members had families, they would die by the hands of Nazis. André had sent his beloved family to a secret location in southern Italy. The officer walked back around his desk and sat down. Then he said, "At this present moment, we have your wife and two little girls in the hands of the SS in Barletta. If you simply write down the address of Jean Moulin on this piece of paper, we will immediately take them back to their home. However, if you fail to cooperate with us, we will be forced to let the SS execute them. Your wife will be questioned and then hanged, and your two children drowned. Then we will torture you until you tell us what we want to know. And you will tell us everything, believe me. However, if you do decide to be sensible and help us, we will drive you to Italy to be reunited with your family. You have until noon to make up your mind what you will do." He then stood up from his desk and left the room. André's head spun with confusion. It was as though his whole life suddenly came crashing in on him. If he cooperated, he would be a traitor to his country. And if he didn't... He leaned forward and thumped the desk in anger. For 3 hours, André wrestled with his options. He wept aloud, he cursed, he prayed. He contemplated suicide by smashing the glass from the barred window high above the officer's desk and cutting his wrists. But what good would that do? They would see that as a refusal to cooperate and kill his family anyway. When the SS officer entered the room, André was bent double with his head in his hands. He took one of André's hands and put a pencil in it. He looked at the Nazi with utter disdain, then down at the blank piece of paper on the desk in front of him. He leaned forward and, with a trembling hand, wrote an address on the paper. On July 8, 1943, the Germans announced that Jean Moulin, the leader of the French resistance, had died. He had been tortured for a month. He was 44. Lillian had been with Jean the night he was arrested. There were rumors that she had also been tortured, then sent to Auschwitz. Chapter 7. There is no God. After the death of Jean and the disappearance of Lillian, Jerry became disheartened and decided that he would move out of the city into the country and have a break from his work for the liberation of France. The place he chose to move to was the small village of Audouin-Souglan. Despite the occupation, it was remarkably free from the concentration of soldiers that were in Paris. There, he met a soft-spoken French girl named Monique. She reminded him of Lillian because of her passion to liberate France from the Germans. As the days went by, he found himself loving her as he had never loved before. She seemed to kindle the fire back in his heart to stand up against the Germans. When it was possible, they would sneak away and go for long walks, and he would tell her of his childhood in Texas. She even convinced him to visit the small church in the village on Sundays. After living in Audouin for 3 months, thanks to Monique, he fully regained his passion to liberate France from the Nazis, so he decided that he would return to Paris to keep in contact with the resistance in the city. Upon his return from Paris 3 days later, he found that the Germans had killed every person they could find in the tiny village. A total of 642 people had been slaughtered, including Monique. The Nazis were avenging the capture of an SS officer by the resistance. An unconfirmed rumor said he was executed in Audouin. A witness said that the SS encircled the village, divided the men into 5 or 6 groups, then herded them into barns. The women and children were locked into the church. The men were shot first, then the churches were set on fire. When the women and children tried to escape, they were shot dead. At 6 o'clock that evening, the Germans stopped a train and arrested and shot all those who were heading for Audouin. News of this sickened Jerry beyond words. It was as though the bitterness of life had struck a death blow to his very soul. He withdrew into a deep anger both at the Nazis and at God who had allowed them to cause such suffering. When he went back to Paris, he heard through the BBC that in Rome the Gestapo had indiscriminately arrested 2 Italian priests, a number of Jews, some women, and 2 14-year-old boys and shot them to death. They were killed in reprisal for a bomb attack that had slain 33 German policemen. Hitler had demanded that 50 Italians be executed for each German that died, but German officials in Italy reduced the ratio. One thing after another fueled a fire of rage. A number of Frenchmen who had been fighting alongside the Nazis gathered at the famed velodrome and waved French flags and wore German uniforms. They were called the Legion of Volunteers Against Bolshevism. Their only complaint was that the Germans weren't giving them enough to do. They were tired of watching roads and railway stations. They wanted to hunt down the resistance and those they called terrorists. On hearing that Frenchmen sympathized with the Germans, Jerry decided to soon leave France and go to Britain. Some days later, someone gave him some of Lillian's belongings. Among them was the Bible that his father read from as he prayed that Britain and France would deliver him and his family from the Nazis. He muttered, "Some help that was." Then he threw it to the floor and spat out, "There is no God." That conclusion seemed to justify his anger. The very thought of a divine being made him bitter. He had seen God with us engraved on the belt buckles of the Nazi soldiers. Even the demented Führer believed in God. A year earlier, he came across portions of Mein Kampf. When the First World War began and lifted Hitler from obscurity, it was recorded in his book how the war elated him by saying, "I fell on my knees and thanked heaven from an overflowing heart." Jerry's newfound atheism gave him some sort of solace and explanation for the sufferings he saw around him. If there was an omnipotent God, how could he sit idly by and watch his sister and Jean suffer? How could a God of love let Monique and her family, the Italian priests and women and children, be so brutally murdered? And of all things, how could he do nothing while Jews, his chosen people, were being slaughtered by the millions? Terrible things had trickled back from the camps. people, even children, being used by, quote, doctors, as guinea pigs in testing lethal germs, amputations, and toxins. He heard that Polish and Soviet officials estimated that 1.5 million people were put to death at the Majdanek concentration camp. The victims were Jews and Christians, men, women, and children from every nation in Europe. The camp was in an area covering 670 acres and was surrounded by an electric barbed fence. Outside the fence, there were 14 machine gun turrets. Prisoners were processed very efficiently. They were first herded into the bathhouses and stripped. Then their clothes were sent to Germany to supplement the German wardrobe. They were then moved into another room which was sealed except for holes placed high in the roof. From the holes, canisters of a toxic gas were dropped below. The warm showers the people took opened their pores, permitting the gas to take effect more quickly. Prison guards watched through glass panes in the ceiling to make sure everyone was dead. Bodies were then removed and taken to the furnace, where teeth and gold fillings were knocked out and sold later. Bodies were burned in 10 to 12 minutes, meaning that when the crematoriums were efficiently used, 1,900 bodies could be burned a day. The ashes were then sold to German farmers as fertilizer. No, there was no God. Chapter 8. Tall Order. We want him killed, but we don't want any holes in the uniform. It was a strange order, but an important one. Churchill himself had requested that the resistance find out exactly where the aircraft assembly plants were stationed in Berlin, and Jerry was the only one who qualified for the task of finding out that information. The Allies wanted detailed maps for their bombers, and he was familiar with Berlin as he had often traveled there on business while in Waldenburg. He spoke the language, and most important, they could trust him to get the job done. All that was needed was a uniform to fit a man who was 6 feet 1 inch tall, and the ID to go with it. In accordance with the tall order, two members of the resistance followed a lanky SS officer as he walked out of a club late one night and down a lonely street towards one of the many brothels of Paris. It was unusual to see a Nazi officer in that part of the town by himself, but he was obviously drunk and therefore not too concerned about what could happen to him. The man was so inebriated, one of the Frenchmen merely had to whisper, "Hey, Fritz!" And when the soldier turned towards him, the other quickly put a piece of wire around his neck and pulled tight. It was quick, quiet, and clean. The uniform was delivered in perfect condition. Jerry was straining at the bit to do something big to frustrate the Nazi cause before he left for Britain. The plan was to drop him by parachute in a field about 3 miles east of Berlin. He would have to bury his parachute, make his own way to the city, and locate as many assembly plants as he could within 1 week. Then he would have to get back to the airfield and be picked up at 1900 hours 7 nights later. The only way they could possibly carry out such a dangerous assignment was for the plane to land and take off in thick fog, something that was a certainty in that area at that time of the year. The risks both of air and ground travel would be great, but if he could deliver the information to the Allies, the hazards were well worth it. He would carry false papers giving him direct orders from Hitler's personal secretary, Martin Bormann. They were a mandate giving Jerry free course in Berlin to carry out specific details of Bormann's brainchild to purify the German race, producing what was referred to as the Aryan elite. The fountain of life, predicted Bormann, would produce 10,000 purified children by the end of the war who would live in 22 homes administered by the society. The Nazis had already torn 200,000 children with Aryan characteristics from their parents in Norway, Poland, and Czechoslovakia to be raised as Germans. It was late on the night of January 2, 1944. Jerry sat alone in the back of a B-29 bomber which the resistance kept hidden in a large cave near Cherbourg. They had boarded up the entrance with authentic-looking signs saying that it was condemned and dangerous, and even placed loose rocks at the entrance that crumbled if any of the boards were moved. He checked his parachute once again, and upon command from a member of the crew, jumped into the darkness of the night and looked skyward to see the plane fly off into the distance. The following day, a farmer drove him into Berlin. He told the farmer that his motorbike had had a blowout and lay crumpled in a ditch. The man seemed satisfied with that story, and without further question, drove him into town. The following night, Jerry entered a bar and saw an officer of the SS sitting alone. There was no way he could even remotely inquire about aircraft assembly plants without arousing suspicion. He merely planned to make a friend, trying to gauge the man's loyalties to the state. He had hoped that he would find someone who believed that the Nazi cause was unjust. In German, he asked, "Do you mind if I sit here?" The man didn't say a word, but pushed a chair out with his foot so Jerry could sit down opposite him. The German was friendly, but even if he had been sympathetic to the Allied cause, there was little chance he would have let it be known. In the course of conversation, he found that a week earlier, a soldier whose tongue had been loosened by a few beers spoke too loudly about something he considered the Third Reich had done to be detrimental to Germany. About an hour later, the SS showed up and took him away for questioning. At 11 o'clock the next day, he was taken to the main square and shot in public, and his body left tied to a post for 2 days as a warning to others not to resist the state. They wanted it to be known that if they didn't hesitate to shoot one of their own, they would gladly deal with others who refused to come into line with their wishes. Jerry decided that the only place he would find someone who would give him the information he needed was in one of Berlin's ghettos. As he stood at the checkpoint of the largest of the ghettos, an officer looked closely at his papers and asked, "Why are you wanting to enter here?" Jerry answered with an air of authority, "We understand that a number of Norwegian children are being hidden by the Jews. I have come to make a few inquiries. I find that a little money here and there can loosen the tightest tongue, especially when the belly is hungry." The officer smiled, obviously impressed that the orders came from Bormann himself, and said, "To make sure you are not put in danger, I will provide you with an escort of 2 soldiers on my personal vehicle." As the automobile was driven through the ghetto, Jerry looked in horror at starving women whose husbands had either been imprisoned in the nearby concentration camps or shot. They were lying with their children on the sidewalks. After driving around for about 10 minutes, he told the driver to stop the vehicle, charged both soldiers to stay in the car, and walked over to a woman who lay on the cold sidewalk. Rachel slowly opened the door of what used to be one of the many kitchens in the region of the ghetto. The wide-open mouths of the cupboards told their own pathetic story. There were nothing but piles of rat droppings. The only reason she entered the kitchen was because of the flickering light of the candle on the table. She thought that someone may have found food and may give her some. Anything to stop the gnawing in the pit of her stomach. The only person inside was old Rabbi Cohen, sitting at the large table reading the Bible. She had often seen him clutching it as he shuffled around the ghetto. Disheartened, she slumped down on the floor in a corner. Another pain, greater than the hunger, gripped her heart. It was the memory of seeing her beloved husband shot before her eyes by the Nazis and his body thrown onto the back of a truck like refuse from the streets. As the sun rose and made the candle unnecessary, the old rabbi lifted his eyes, licked his thumb and forefinger, and squeezed out the flame. She stared at the smoking wick and thought of the black smoke that ascended continually from Buchenwald concentration camp and thought how the Nazis were snuffing out her people. As she looked at its smoke, she was distracted from her thoughts by the sound of a page being turned in the rabbi's book. She stared at him for 15 minutes. His eyes didn't look up for a moment from its pages. At last, she broke the silence.
"Why do you read that book?"
There was a bitter cynicism in her tone. He didn't look up, but merely said,
It is my food.
She felt annoyed that he could say such a stupid thing, but before she could answer him, he continued.
Some people have 1,000 questions. With this book, I have 1,000 answers.
My mother used to read that book. She went to Ravensbrook.
He still didn't look up, but just said,
Do you have questions or answers?
Rachel didn't reply. His words echoed in her mind.
Do you have questions or answers?
After 5 minutes, he lifted his eyes, adjusted his glasses on his nose, and looked over at her.
My dear, I warned our people that money had become our god, but they wouldn't listen. They retired this raving old Jeremiah, but I warned them.
He could see that Rachel's facial expression questioned what he meant, so he continued.
Listen to the book of Jeremiah as the God of our fathers speaks to his people. How shall I pardon thee for this? Thy children have forsaken me and sworn by them that are no gods. When I had fed them to the full, they then committed adultery and assembled themselves by troops in the harlots' houses. They were as fed horses in the morning, every one neighed after his neighbor's wife. Shall I not visit for these things, saith the Lord? And shall not my soul be avenged on a nation as this?
The old rabbi's face looked sullen as he said,
Then judgment came. Their widows are increased to me above the sand of the seas. I have brought upon them against the mother of the young men a spoiler at noonday. I have caused him to fall upon it suddenly, and terrors upon the city. And the residue of them will I deliver to the sword before their enemies, saith the Lord. They shall die grievous deaths. They shall not be lamented, neither shall they be buried, but they shall be as dung upon the face of the earth. For years I warned our people that they could not love money, commit adultery, live in greed and selfishness, and forget the law of their God. I told them that God would judge us, to bring us back to himself, if they would not turn from their wickedness. I read them the words of Jeremiah, Give glory to the Lord your God before he caused darkness, and before your feet stumble upon the dark mountains, and while you look for light, he turneth into the shadow of death, and maketh gross darkness. But, if you will not hear it, my soul shall weep in secret places for your pride, and mine eyes shall weep sore, and run down with tears, because the Lord's flock is carried away captive.
He looked up from the book, and with tears streaming down his cheeks, said,
My dear, our light has turned to gross darkness, but our God is rich in mercy to all who call upon him. He will judge Germany, and once again cause his face to shine upon us. One day the Messiah will come and restore all things. The God of our fathers will draw us back to Jerusalem. He who scattered Israel will gather him.
His naivete angered her. Rachel glared at him and said,
I cannot accept your God. He is a tyrant.
He looked back and said,
Hitler is the tyrant. Can't you see that you are doing what Israel did? You are creating your own God. Jeremiah has been labeled a prophet of doom, but he was a prophet of good tidings. His very name means Jehovah will exalt. God was willing, so willing to turn from his wrath and exalt his people by pouring his blessings on them, but they refused to turn from their rebellious ways. That was their choice. We, as a nation, had that same choice.
What choice is this? We are starving to death. I have no money, no food, no family. I cannot believe that God would just sit back and allow this to happen to his people.
Rabbi Cohen looked back at the scriptures he had just read and said, "My dear, he has." That remark enraged her. As she stood to her feet, the rabbi calmly said, "But I have not seen the righteous forsaken or his children begging bread." With that, she snapped.
"You stay here and die. I am going to beg for bread."
And stormed out of the room and slammed the door. That day, her anger energized her to walk the streets of the ghetto looking for food. Sometime in the afternoon, she became so desperate she decided to sell her body to any man that would take her. But all she could find were widows and old sickly men. She was weak and sickly herself as she returned to her section of the ghetto and fainted on the sidewalk near where she had left more than 7 hours earlier. It was on that cold sidewalk that she whispered,
"O God of my fathers, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Jehovah Jireh, I have sinned against you. Help me."
It was then that a shadow crossed her weary face and startled her. As she focused her eyes, to her horror, she saw the tall figure of an SS officer. She cowered back in fear as he bent down. Then he gently opened her hand and, to her disbelief, placed within it a roll of money and said, "Do not be afraid. My name is Jeremiah Adamson. I am an American working with the French resistance. Please, I must find out where the German aircraft plants are in Berlin." Rachel listened to the tone of his voice and looked at his earnest expression. She looked at the soldiers waiting in the car, then back at Jerry. "They think I'm an officer of the SS on special assignment for the Führer, trying to uncover information about missing Norwegian children." Then he smiled slightly and said, "The resistance can produce some fine German paperwork." Again he said, "Please, it is vital to the Allied cause. I wouldn't lie to you. All I need is the locations. You may keep all the money. Buy yourself something to eat." Rachel was stunned by what had just taken place. Seconds earlier, she had prayed to the God of Israel to provide for her. She thought for a moment, scrambled to her feet, and said,
"Wait here."
Then disappeared around a corner. Jerry walked back to the soldiers and said, "I think I am onto something. The woman has seen two children that don't look like Jews. A little money goes a long way in making a Jew talk." They smiled. Then he wandered back to the sidewalk. The rabbi looked up in shock as Rachel thrust open the kitchen door. He had fallen asleep with the Bible still open at the book of Jeremiah. When she left, her eyes were dull and lifeless, but now they sparkled with life as she said,
"The God of our fathers has not forsaken us. He heard my prayer."
And held the money up before his startled face. When she told him what had happened, he said, "My dear, God be praised. This is truly wonderful. I have the name of a man who could give this American all the information he needs. But how can I be sure this is not a trap? I could be signing this man's death warrant. What if this is a Nazi scheme to..." Rachel held up her hand to stop his words and said,
"Rabbi, this man is from God. I forgot to tell you his name. It's Jeremiah."
It was January 20, 1944. Jerry wasn't alone as he sat in his back room in Paris and listened to the BBC.
"The RAF dropped 2,300 tons of bombs over Berlin today, just 1 week after a massive array of 1,400 American planes darkened the central German skies, unloading a barrage of bombs that obliterated three key Nazi aircraft assembly plants. Despite the loss of 59 heavy bombers and 5 fighter jets, the United States 8th Air Force called its assault a major military success, and German dispatches even acknowledged that the enemy was technically superior. The three plants hit were Oschersleben, Halberstadt, and Brunswick, all important factories of war for the Third Reich. virtually all available planes in the Luftwaffe arsenal, about 100, were used in defense. Of those, 28 were downed by American fighters.
Chapter 9. Crawling with Germans. Jerry picked up his only possessions after nearly 4 years of fighting in the resistance: his sister's torn Bible, his father's .38, and one change of clothes which he carried in a small brown leather suitcase. He wanted out of France. He had accomplished the sweetest of victories in Berlin, but he had seen too many terrible things for a man his age. The Nazis had stolen his youth. He had abandoned his American papers since the U.S. entered the war and traveled under French papers given to him by the resistance. They arranged for him to be picked up and transported by car from Paris to the small fishing village of Port-en-Bisson. There he would be taken by a fishing boat across the English Channel to New Haven, where he would be met and taken to the British Foreign Office in London, 50 miles to the north. As he and two members of the resistance, Pierre and Jacques, set out on a cold and clear night of June 4, it should have been a simple thing for the three fishermen to return to their village after selling produce in Paris. But they had a growing uneasiness as they neared the coast. The remote area of the countryside was crawling with Germans. They passed battalion after battalion and trucks towing 20-millimeter guns. Jacques said, "I am from Port-en-Bisson, and I have never seen it like this." There were thousands of soldiers being transported, and the checkpoints became more and more frequent. The men grew silent as they approached the lights of what was normally a quiet fishing village. Pierre said, "I don't like this." Jerry felt the same. "Why don't we pull over to the side of the road?" Pierre didn't hesitate. He swung the car to the edge of the road and turned its lights off. It was very dark as the men sat and stared ahead of them. They could hear the rumbling of tanks and trucks and see the silhouettes of artillery being driven through the tiny village. "The invasion. They must have the details of the invasion," whispered Jerry. British intelligence had informed the resistance on June 1, via a coded message on the BBC, of the Allies' invasion of France. However, because Jerry had withdrawn earlier from active work with the resistance, he had not been privy to the particulars. The three men decided that it would be too risky to drive into the village or try and return to Paris that night. The Germans wouldn't want French fishermen rising up at their backs while the Allies were attacking at the front. There was no doubt that they would have either imprisoned or shot the locals. They decided to travel by foot through the fields to the outskirts of the village and try and get particulars on what was going on. The three men crouched behind a small rowing boat and listened to the sound of German voices coming from the kitchen of a fisherman's modest home. They were about 500 yards from the center of the village, near the edges of cliffs overlooking the English Channel. The roar of the waves on the still cold night made it difficult to hear what the voices were saying. Suddenly, the three men crouched low as the front door of the house swung open and an SS officer stood on the front porch. He looked around thoughtfully, then up to the clear sky, and took a deep breath. Then he put his hand into his pocket and pulled out a flat silver case, slowly opened it as though his mind was elsewhere, took out a cigarette, and hit the end of it against the palm of his left hand. When he put the cigarette into his mouth and lit it, Jacques slowly lifted the binoculars that hung around his neck to his eyes. From the uniform he could see that this was top brass, a general. As the glow from the cigarette lighter illuminated the man's face, Jacques whispered, "It's Karl von Schlieben." After smoking only half of the cigarette, the general dropped it onto the wooden floor and put it out with his foot, as though he had suddenly thought of something important, and walked back into the house. Jacques longed to get closer, but the place was alive with activity, and two soldiers stood guard at the entrance. Pierre took hold of the glasses and moved to one side so that he could see through a window, almost choking Jacques as he did so with the strap which was still around his neck. He smiled as he lifted it over his head. The general was leaning over something on the table in front of him.
From what Pierre could see, two other generals and four or five top SS officers stood around him. When one moved to one side, he could see that they were looking at a map which was spread out on a table. It was obvious, with such an elite gathering, that this was the defensive strategy for the Ally invasion. Pierre said,
"From the information we have, and by the look of what's happening here, I would say the Allies will land in this area either tomorrow or the next day on June 6th.
He knew the area well, and said that if it was where the Allies had chosen to land troops, they would be sitting ducks under the artillery on the cliffs. The men decided to wait until morning and see in the light of day the extent of the German military. During the night, the three men made their way to a high area about 2 miles along the coast. From there, they would be able to see the cliffs overlooking the Val de la Somme. As the sun rose, they peered in amazement at the sight before them. As far as the eye could see, there were masses of German high-powered artillery set back from the edges of the cliffs. On the cliff edges were bunkers, each containing two soldiers with machine guns. As Jacques looked at the incredible scene of so many guns and men, he broke the silence with, "Dear God, if they land on this beach, they will be slaughtered." During the hours of that day, the men remained in the thicket on the cliffs, straining their eyes toward the horizon, planning what they would do. They decided to wait until nightfall and get as close as they could to the bunker at the right-hand end of the cliffs. That position was strategic, as it was a little higher than the rest of the area. It was 6 a.m. the next day. Without taking his eyes away from the small pair of binoculars he held in his hand, Pierre suddenly awakened the two sleeping men with his hand and said, "There they are." Jerry shook the sleep from his eyes, took hold of the glasses, and uttered, "Look at that sight." It truly was an awesome spectacle. It was still dark, but the entire horizon glowed with the pre-dawn sun and stood as a backdrop for the blackened silhouettes of 5,000 battleships. Allied battleships. Jerry stared at the sight. This was the trumpet-blowing cavalry coming for the remnant of fighting soldiers. It was a realization of the prayers of millions in war-torn Europe. There was no time to spare. The three men quickly covered their faces with charcoal and scurried down the hillside towards the first bunker. They knew that every German eye would be toward the horizon. With the glow of the pre-dawn sun, they could see the outline of two men sitting beside a large machine gun. One had his hand readied on top of the weapon and his eyes on the horizon. The other was also staring silently in the same direction, as steam rose from his right hand, revealing that he was holding on to a hot drink. In the hush of the morning, the three resistance fighters silently slid down into the bunker. Either the Germans thought it was their friends joining them in the bunker, or they were so intent on the enemy before them, they didn't hear the enemy behind them. It was almost too easy as the three resistance fighters cupped their hands over the mouths of the Germans, pulled them to the ground, and thrust their knives into their bodies. They quickly pulled them to one side, stripped them of their jackets and helmets, then Pierre and Jerry put them on and took hold of the machine gun. The next outpost was a mere 60 feet away, but the operation had been so quiet they hadn't aroused any suspicion. This concludes set number one. The mystery continues on set number two.